I'm Sally Steenland, and I direct the Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative here at the Center for American Progress. With me today is Nancy Kaufman. She's the Chief Executive Officer of the National Council of Jewish Women, a grassroots organization of volunteers and advocates who turn progressive ideals into action. Inspired by Jewish values, NCJW strives for social justice by improving the quality of life for women, children, and families, and by safeguarding individual rights and freedoms. Nancy has had a distinguished career as a public servant, advocate, and nonprofit leader. She's worked for the Jewish Community Relations Council of Boston, at the Governor's Office of Social Policy in Massachusetts, and for health and human service agencies. Nancy's a graduate of Brandeis University, and she received a master's degree in community organization and social planning from the School of Social Work at Boston College, as well as a master's degree in public administration from the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Very impressive. Welcome, Nancy. We're so glad you're with us today. So let's just start right away. And I want to ask you about the National Council of Jewish Women, which is over 100 years old, which is really quite impressive. So bring us back to when the organization was started and what were some of the most important issues and top priority issues when NCJW was new, and then how about today?
Well, NCJW was founded in 1893. It was one of the first national Jewish organizations founded, even predated the first Jewish Federation. And it was founded in Chicago, Illinois, when a woman by the name of Hannah G. Solomon, a wealthy German-Jewish immigrant to the United States, was invited to the Academy of World Religions at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893, and when she was invited as a volunteer, and when she got there, she was asked to pour the tea, and she said at the time that Jewish women can do more than pour tea.
Wow!
Decided to return to her community in Chicago. And her contemporaries at the time, she was a friend of Jane Addams and a supporter of the Settlement House movement, and decided to take a page out of that book and began to organize Jewish women in order to make a difference in their own community and in the broader community. So it was really, she was a visionary. It was way ahead of her time.
Way.
She saw the poverty and injustice that was going on all around her. She saw the overcrowding conditions in housing and the terrible conditions, the working conditions that new immigrants were exposed to. And she said, we need to organize and we need to do something about this. So it started as a largely domestic policy organization, grassroots organization. She decided that when she started in Chicago, she then said, needs to happen in every community across the country where there is a significant Jewish population. We as Jews are mandated by our faith and tradition to pursue justice, and therefore we must strive for social justice every day in all of our work, and decided to focus specifically on women and children and the kind of challenges that women and children were facing. And in those years, in the early years, it was the plight of the new immigrant. It was the issue of really grassroots, you know, working conditions, housing conditions, health care, poverty, all of those issues. And going forward, really, we have been on the cutting edge of every major social movement in this country. And we, by organizing and using organizing as a strategy from the get-go, we have taken the voices of Jewish women and said, we as Jewish women care about these particularly important things to us as Jews, but because we care about universal social justice.
Wow.
So again, what began as poverty and in communities across the country, then became other issues. You know, suffrage, the women's vote, the right of women to you know, control their own bodies, racial injustice. I mean, you name it.
Right.
You look back over the 120 years, we have been sort of the voice of progressive Jewish women in this country.
Wow. What an honor to head up such an incredible organization. It's really, really impressive. Wow. You mentioned immigrants at the outset of NCJW, and I know that so 100 years later, there's an immigration bill on the floor of the Senate, and I know that you, NCJW, has been part of working for immigration reform. So talk about that as an important issue to your organization and some of the things you're doing.
Well, you know, again, this is an issue that really was really one of the initial reasons we were founded. So, you know, what goes around comes around.
Yeah.
Actually, right now in the Library of Congress, there's a exhibit called Sapphires, and I was very struck. I was looking at it when I was there in December, and, you know, I look around the exhibit, and I see this little pamphlet by the National Council of Jewish Women in 1923, A Guide to Immigrant Women.
Wow.
And it was at a time that when women were coming in the 20s and the 30s to Ellis Island, women from and we've heard of these stories and we've read about it, women from National Council of Jewish Women would meet the women coming in on the boats at the port because they were worried about trafficking.
Oh.
They knew that there were going to be traffickers waiting for them.
Wow.
To take them in, you know, to be trafficked.
Yeah.
In the early stages of trafficking. And so they set up, they basically saved the women. They took them under their wing. They arranged for housing. They arranged for safety. So that has been an issue that we're about to reemerge on.
Yeah.
And we, you know, that obviously, it sadly, is still an issue. So,
yeah.
You know, the issue of immigration and treating the new arrivals for us is sort of core to who we are.
Yeah.
And we all know that women, much of the time, are the ones who suffer the most because it's their families who, you know, are disrupted.
Yeah.
It's them who come here to work and then send money back to their families in their home countries. And so fast forward today to the whole comprehensive immigration reform, and we believe it needs to be comprehensive immigration reform. It's an issue that we're most concerned about, and particularly concerned about around women and children.
Yeah.
And, you know, have been leading a series of efforts around that to make sure that this immigration bill is a bill that is fair and just.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've been focused, I mean, most recently we were focused on the Grassley Amendment,
mm-hmm.
95. That was an amendment that would delay access to the path to citizenship by not allowing registered provisional immigrants to register until the Secretary of DHS certified to Congress that she's been maintained, quote, effective control over the entire southern border for 6 months. I mean, so, you know, we've been basically saying that the amendment could significantly delay even the initial registration for the 11 million undocumented individuals already in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And saying that the pathway to citizenship, you know, that's in Senate Bill 744 is already tough.
Yep.
It's long. It must be earned. It also must be attainable.
Yep.
And we believe that amendment would further delay a process that already would take at least 13 years. And if people of faith,
right.
People of faith, we are directed to welcome the stranger.
Yeah, right, right.
We take that very literally.
Yeah.
And to impede the path to citizenship with stringent and unrelated triggers goes against this fundamental precept.
Yeah.
So, you know, we feel that the drafters of the bill worked long and hard to reach bipartisan agreement on the enforcement triggers in the bill, and that this just as an example, this amendment would undermine that hard-fought bipartisan agreement. So those are the kinds of ways in which we are paying particular attention,
mm-hmm.
you know, some of the issues that we are concerned about. We're also part of a coalition through the Jewish Social Justice Roundtable, of which we are a member and I'm on the leadership team of. And we are doing work specifically in Florida and Ohio, trying to organize around those senatorial districts. Around this. So we do, you know, what's wonderful about National Council of Jewish Women and wonderful about Hannah Solman's initial vision is that it's local and national.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we have a strong inside the Beltway presence with our Washington office, and we have a strong grassroots presence in hundreds of communities across the country and state policy advocates in 22 states and really volunteer-driven effort of real grassroots and women who really don't just talk the talk, they walk the walk.
Right.
They show up at their state capitals.
Right.
They show up when we call them to Washington. They show up in recess with their elected representative.
Right. And that's, you know, that's such a double strength, because sometimes there are organizations that have a very strong grassroots outreach effort, but they don't always have either policy expertise or a national presence. And then there are groups have policy expertise and national presence, but they've got no outreach in states. And increasingly, as things are happening in the states, it's really important to have that. So can you just talk a little bit more about that strength? So in terms of what you're hearing from your chapters in various states, in terms of sequestration, are you hearing stories that you are then bringing back to Washington? How does that two-way thing, that two-way street go, where the policy then advocacy gets shared with people on the ground, and then those stories and that expertise goes back and forth? Tell us how that works.
Right, exactly. So, you know, we have a very well-oiled, we think, operation. And it actually really works. We have our policy staff in Washington. One of our people in Washington works specifically with what we call our state policy advocate.
Mm-hmm.
In as many states as we possibly can cover right now, it's about 22 of the states. We'd like it to be all of them, obviously. We have someone called the state policy advocate. That person works with all the NCJW. We call them sections, not chapters.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All the NCJW sections in the state. And organizes, obviously, in coalition with other groups.
Sure.
And so the message comes down from Washington, because they're following what, you know, who, where the squeaky wheel is, what we have to do, who we have to get to,
sure,
what's happening, and goes to these state policy advocates, who then organize women to maybe showing up in a congressman or a senator's office, and maybe showing up in their state capital, depending on, you know, what's moving. So that's sort of at the highest level. Then we also, here in New York, support the 88 sections across the country who feed into that state policy advocacy, but also are working at the local level to basically engage people in this NCJW work, that, you know, and engage members and have meetings and conferences and do education. I mean, all of our work is around sort of four strategies: education, mm-hmm, philanthropy, advocacy, and community service.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I like to say, if you've met one section, you've met one section.
Uh-huh.
As you know from my bio that you just shared, I'm a community organizer by
right.
training, and I really believe, you know, as the great late Tip O'Neill used to say, all politics
is local, right?
And that is true.
Yeah.
It really is
yeah.
true. And you have yeah. to understand that if you want to be effective. I don't care if it's in Washington or it's in Des Moines.
Yeah.
You have to understand that that's the way our government works, and thank God it does, because that's why we're part of a democracy. So, just an example, members of the National Council of Jewish Women attended a joint meeting on May 30th in Palm Beach Gardens with Senator Mark Rubio and his staff to speak specifically about the immigration.
Mm-hmm.
So we were part of that. And then, you know, four leaders from NCJW in Rochester met with Tom Reed's staff during the recess week to discuss comprehensive immigration reform. And then they feed back what they hear about.
Sure.
Los Angeles section had a town hall meeting with Congressman Adam Schiff. It was attended by close to 100 members of the community. Audience had a chance to submit questions. I mean, that's the kind of thing that we're doing all the
yeah.
time. And we urge our leaders in target states, for instance, to join the Alliance for Citizenship,
mm-hmm.
so that they can be part of broader coalitions, because we don't really believe that, you know, change is going to happen by us going it alone. We really believe that we have to be in coalition with other groups. So we partner with different groups depending mm-hmm. on the issue, and we try to be very focused. Right now, our three main issues are comprehensive immigration reform, an end to gun violence, and reproductive choice, you know, falling
yep.
that in
yep.
on top of that all the time. So those are just our three priority issues. It doesn't mean that we're not, you know, paying attention to other things, but, you know, we try to kind of be very
sure.
focused.
Sure.
In order to be effective.
So let me just pick up on reproductive choice then,
mm-hmm.
because a lot of bad stuff is happening in states
yeah.
around that. And you know, often it's religious opponents who and political conservatives who are leading that charge. So here you are, a strong faith tradition, supporting reproductive choice and doing it because of your faith. So can you just talk a little bit about that in terms of, you know, Judaism support for women's moral autonomy and reproductive health and choice?
Well, you know, conservative religious leaders and their allies have been unfortunately successful in establishing a conventional wisdom among many lawmakers that asserts that women's health and religious liberty are separate issues.
Right.
That just is not how
we feel.
That's
not true, right.
They believe that religious liberty is for organizations and institutions, and women's health is a separate conversation.
Right.
And I think that's why we're unique. When people say to me, what's the difference between you and Planned Parenthood? I say, we have a very different, you know, role. I'm a big supporter of Planned Parenthood, but they're about women's health.
Right.
They're not about religious liberty.
Right.
We're about religious liberty and women's health.
Right.
And they have these folks who, you know, tried to seize the day have painted an inaccurate picture of what religious liberty means.
Right.
Of who it protects, whom it protects, how regular people of faith feel about reproductive health.
Right.
And they don't speak for the millions of people we know from the polling of faith across the country from different faiths, but particularly from the Jewish faith, who feel differently.
Right.
So, you know, and you know, so you come down to sort of we as Jews feel, wait a minute, who's religious?
Who's religious liberty are we talking about here?
Yeah. There are people in the Catholic community who feel who's religious, but we particularly feel
exactly.
You know, the decision to plan a family or end a pregnancy are personal health decisions, we believe, that are fundamentally linked to religious liberty.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm not telling anyone they should have an abortion. I'm not telling anyone they should use birth control, but nor should anyone tell me what I can do.
Right.
You know, within my faith tradition, between me and my rabbi or my husband or, you know, that's just wrong.
Right.
So we believe that each of us must be free to make these decisions according to our own religious beliefs, our own moral values, and our own particular faith tradition. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
And our Constitution, thank God. And I mean, unlike I'm about to leave for Israel tomorrow and, you know, I'm giving a talk there about Judaism and women's equality because, unfortunately, they don't have separation. We do. Our founding fathers, and they were fathers, you know, knew that we needed to preserve the right to religious freedom.
Right.
And, you know, we're in a democratic, pluralistic society. And in a democratic and pluralistic society, we respect others' personal religious and moral beliefs, and we believe the two are separate.
Right.
So it's very troubling, I think, in 2013 that we're not respecting what we've always respected, you know, us who believe in the Constitution. And we think that every person should be given due respect for holding their own personal religious beliefs. And as lawmakers, you know, our elected officials must not privilege one view over another by enacting laws that restrict access to legal health care in order to deny a woman from making her own faith-informed decisions about her health and family.
Right.
I mean, it's very clear.
Right.
And so, you know, the issue of access to care, about women, you know, being able to access birth control or access services, refusal policies that are manifested, you know, manifest as proposals to let private employees deny their workers birth control coverage, or something like the Hyde Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Which unjustly withholds coverage of abortion for many women, including federal workers.
Right.
Policies that restrict access to care due to a particular religious belief erode our reproductive and religious freedom.
So how do we push back? Because I totally agree with you. But the apocalyptic rhetoric on the other side that there's this unprecedented attack on religious liberty, and it's this alliance of, you know, the Catholic bishops, conservative evangelicals, some Mormons, and some other groups, as well as you've now gotten with these lawsuits some profit-making corporations who do not want to provide coverage for contraceptive in their insurance plans. Companies that employ thousands of people who don't share their beliefs at all. So, you know, if you and I were having this conversation, we'd say, well, that's not fair. You don't get to pick the laws you want to obey and to say, I'm going to opt out of that one. But how do you make the argument in the public square, say to some, you know, everyday American who's like not following this issue the way you and I might be, what would you say?
Well, I would say that that if we want a society where we're free to practice our religion,
yep,
and we want to be able to do that, we would have to urge, it's our responsibility as Americans and many people of faith to safeguard access to care as a moral imperative.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really think the rhetoric has come from ideology.
Yeah.
That really some people, a minority, I think, want to impose upon the majority.
Yeah, no,
and
I agree.
The public perception is usually that religion is somehow opposed to reproductive rights.
Right.
But that's, especially abortion.
Right.
Well, that's not true in my religion.
Right.
And it, people say, well, Orthodox Jews, even in the Orthodox tradition, it isn't true.
Mm-hmm.
They do believe that the health of the mother is paramount.
Sure.
And this is a decision between, you know, a doctor and a woman. So, you know, religious opinions among Jews differ, surely.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to abortion, but that's why we believe that every woman has the right to make her own faith
sure.
decision.
Sure.
There are many pro-choice religious denominations who agree with us.
Mm-hmm.
We head up the Religious Advocates Working Group in D.C., which is a table where pro-choice faith-based groups collaborate on action around reproductive health and rights issues. We have recently joined with Catholics for Choice and have convened a coalition of organizations to protect our own individual constitutional rights. It's mm-hmm. a broad alliance
mm-hmm.
of faith-based, secular, and other groups that work to ensure that public policy protects the rights of people of all faiths. And no faith, because, you know, there are people no faith, too.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely.
And that, you know, we oppose, you know, anyone who would impose one religious view on all. So I think we have to stay focused on that.
Yeah.
You know, that set of issues and make it really clear. What I seem to be able to get people's attention when I don't do it as ideology. You're right. I'm wrong. I mean, this isn't an issue. They may be perfectly right for them and their family.
Sure.
I'm not trying to convince anyone that they're, you know, they have to do what I would do, but they also have to respect me.
Right.
And what I would do. So, right. You know, I think it's a matter of conversations.
Mm-hmm.
I think what people really, and that's why the polling shows what the polling shows. And that's why when the whole Susan B. Komen thing happened,
yeah.
or, you know, some of these other incidents, there's a reaction. I think that's why the election
right.
was.
Right.
people gone too far.
Right.
You know, you can choose when you're raped. I mean, really?
Yeah.
You know, I that's a choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whether you get pregnant or not when you're
right.
raped. I mean,
like, what?
Yeah. I mean, you know, this is getting a little bit ridiculous. And I think people are seeing that.
Yeah.
You know, I am optimistic, although wondering why we are still fighting this battle,
yeah.
while I'm optimistic that we will win in the end because it's against the American way to do anything else but to separate religion and state.
Well, that's my last question for you. So, because let's end on an optimistic note then. So as you look ahead at your work in the coming days and weeks, and as you look at new young people that you're working with, what's your sense of, you know, the landscape and
uh-huh.
trends in which we're moving? How do you take the temperature of all that?
Well, it's interesting. If you'd asked me that question 6 or 8 months ago,
yeah.
I'd say I was worried. What I was worried about for a long time is my daughter's generation, who
mm-hmm.
has taken it for granted in their lifetimes that, you know, birth control is,
yeah.
you know, they can have, and abortion they can have,
yeah.
and they have access to others. And I think all of this stuff that's happened in the last year has been a bit of a wake-up call
yeah.
For the younger generation.
Mm-hmm.
Realizing that, wait a minute, you know,
birth control, really?
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 Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think, you know, it came out in the Affordable Care Act, the whole issue of contraceptive coverage, I think people are paying attention in a way they haven't before because they're seeing that the issue of religious freedom relates to your own reproductive rights and that you can't have one without the other. So I see the good news and the bad news. The good news and the bad news is that people were watching their televisions over the last year and seeing some of these, you know, crazy things
crazy
that were
stuff.
Happening, like
Coleman. Right.
Crazy stuff, like the
Todd race Aiken.
Bob Aiken. And they're saying, what? I mean, is this really? Are you serious?
Right. My body can shut down pregnancy. Right. Really? I can turn that whole stuff off?
Exactly.
Shut it
and
down?
I really think that there's sort of a turn. And men, too. This isn't just women. Men as allies. And we are very interested in having men as allies. And I think they're saying, wait a minute. I mean, that's not the country I'm signing on to. That's not the, you know, and I don't care if the Democrats or Republicans. I really think there's been a pushback on this.
Yeah.
And I think that is a positive sign. It is a positive sign. And I think that you're going to see more and more of that and less willingness to put up with extreme behavior.
Mm-hmm.
This is extreme behavior.
It is.
This is not the norm. This is extreme behavior being imposed by, you know, a small vocal group of people on the rest of us. And I think people are saying, no way. This is not going to happen. So I think that is a positive sign. I think we've kind of turned a corner, and I think you're going to see, you know, more and more thoughtful discussion and policy, I hope, as we go forward.
Well, and I think just the other day there was another Todd Aiken-like comment by a congressman about rape and getting pregnant. And as social media and other things shine a light on that, it used to be below the radar, kind of the dog whistle coded language. But it's like, really? This is what they believe? I think shining a light on that really does expose and marginalize it.
Absolutely. So I think that's good, and that's why we've existed for 120 years, and we will continue to do the work we do because we think we have a voice within our own community that represents a lot of people and a lot of women in the Jewish world.
And 100 years more to you.
Thank you so much.
And a safe trip to Israel tomorrow, too.
Thank you
so much, Nancy.
Thank
Take care. Bye-bye.